Any health-related information on the following show provides general information only. Content presented on any show by any host or guest should not be substituted for a doctor's advice. Always consult your physician before beginning any new diet, exercise, or treatment program.
Welcome to 5 to Thrive Live, a podcast about thriving for those who have been affected by cancer. I'm Dr. Lise Alschuler, and I co-host 5 to Thrive Live with my good friend and co-author Carolyn Gazella. You can find all past show podcasts on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, iTunes, and all other podcast outlets. Tonight, we are going to explore the commonalities between cancer and heart disease and how this understanding can really inform an integrative approach. And I'm actually very excited about this topic because I've noticed the similarity between these two diseases for many years. In a few moments, I will be joined by Dr. Vivian Cominos. She is a nationally recognized clinician and educator in integrative oncology. She is board certified in both integrative medicine and cardiology, and she's been practicing cardiology for 30 years. And has concentrated on integrative medicine and integrative cardiology for the last 15 years. She is a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine, where she also completed her integrative medicine fellowship. She is very active in integrative medicine. She was one of the founding board members for the American Board of Integrative Medicine, where she served as a vice chair, and she remains a board member today. And she has a clinical practice for integrative medicine, cardiology, and wellness in West Long Branch, New Jersey, which is close to where she lives. So we'll get to her in just a moment. First, I want to thank our podcast sponsors, Dr. O'Hara's Probiotics, a best-selling probiotic for over 30 years with 12 probiotic strains that are shelf-stable without refrigeration due to a unique 3-year fermentation process. And you can learn more at droharaprobiotics.com. That's droharaprobiotics.com. Afia Plus is another sponsor, a new dietary supplement to restore cellular health and function, a patented formulation which contains Aurum Palestinum that has some very interesting cellular rejuvenation properties that's been developed by Hyatt Life Sciences, and you can learn more at Hyatt with two T's, lifesciences.com. Cetria Glutathione provides glutathione, the body's master antioxidant and primary defense against harmful free radicals. Cetria Glutathione is manufactured using a special patented fermentation process, and you can learn more at cetriaglutathione.com. And finally, your 5 to Thrive hosts have developed the iThrive program, which guides survivors to create online, personalized, physician-approved wellness plans, and you can learn more at iThriveplan.com. And if you're joining us live, you're welcome to join the chat. If you go to w4hc.com and click Listen Live at the top, you can also click Chat with Show Host and just put in some questions in the chat, and we'll sprinkle those into our interview. Okay, with no further ado, welcome, Dr. Cominos.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, Lise.
Indeed. Well, you and I had the privilege of talking earlier when we were in a training session for one of the current fellowship classes. So it was nice to see you on Zoom earlier. And, you know, it reminds me, just in terms of conventional doctors becoming integrative practitioners, that it's still sort of a rare thing, especially specialists like cardiologists. I mean, integrative cardiologists, I can count on one hand the number of cardiologists that identify themselves that way. So how did you get on that path?
Well, it might be two hands, and I just want to correct the first thing you said. You introduced me as an integrative oncologist initially, and
I'm
an integrative. It's okay.
Cardiologist. It's
okay. So I'm an integrative cardiologist, and you know, I didn't start that way. I mean, I started my career in private practice. I started my own practice a little over 30 years ago, and I was an invasive cardiologist, and I really loved what I was doing. I loved going to the cath lab. I loved treating heart attacks. I loved being in the hospital and running codes. I thought it was the best. And after about 15 years of doing that and not sleeping and working too many hours, I felt there was something missing. And then something in me really sort of cracked as I was on the other side of the cath lab in the control booth watching stents and balloons being inserted into my husband. And I said, well, I'm missing something. So I went on a search to find out, why is it that I was such a bad cardiologist that my husband has heart disease, right? So I went to a nutrition conference where I met Dr. Weil, and I learned about the fellowship program in integrative medicine. And I signed up for it right away, and I just loved it. I inhaled the program. So it took about another maybe 10 years to turn my practice into an integrative practice. I gave up invasive work. I gave up being a nuclear cardiologist. And now I basically have a lot of fun seeing patients who either are at risk for heart disease and want to prevent it, or people that have heart disease and want to heal from it or reverse heart disease. So that's what I'm doing now and teaching with you. Which I love.
Which we're very grateful for. Well, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people who are in the integrative medicine field as practitioners or patients find themselves there because of a health crisis, either their own or from a loved one. And, you know, that makes it a very legitimate, very heartfelt path. So speaking of heartfelt, I, you know, have to say that in reading the literature around the underlying what we call pathophysiology or disease causation processes of cancer, and then reading, I'm not as well informed, but I would say mildly informed on cardiovascular disease, there's just so many similarities. And I think that the risk factors are, many of them are shared. A lot of the, you know, the way the diseases progress are shared. So let's start with risk factors. What are some of the common or shared risk factors from your perspective between cardiovascular disease and cancer?
Yeah, this is a great topic because, you know, I also have seen like you that they do share many of the same risk factors. And, you know, the cardiovascular disease and cancer are the leading causes of morbidity and mortality in the United States. So I think I'd like to start with the risk factors that we can change. You know, we can't change our age, we can't change our parents, but we could stop smoking if we're smoking. And we know that smoking tobacco increases the risk of cardiovascular disease by up to 4 times that of a non-smoker. But it increases the risk of lung cancer by 25 times. And other cancers are also increased by tobacco, including esophageal, nose, throat. So what we've seen is that fewer and fewer people are smoking compared to decades ago, but it still accounts for about 30% of all the heart disease and of all the cancer that we see. So the good news is that once you stop smoking, within 1 year, the risk for cardiovascular disease and many of the cancers is decreased by half. So that's really, you know, better than any statin. You know, it really decreases the risk tremendously. Mm-hmm. One of the other risk factors is obesity. You know, obesity has reached epidemic proportions now, and it's certainly a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. I think most people know that it's a risk factor for some of the risk factors for cardiovascular disease, such as diabetes and hypertension. You know, it causes an inflammatory state, and that we know is a common pathway to many chronic diseases, including cancer. So people with obesity are especially at risk for gastrointestinal cancers, breast cancer, kidney cancer. Another thing is hypertension. You know, everybody knows that hypertension increases your risk for heart attacks and strokes. About 40% of our population is hypertension. And out of those, only about 50% are adequately treated. Now, this is important because when we look at cancer and hypertension, it may increase the risk for kidney cancer. But on top of that, hypertension is the leading cause for heart failure. And we know that heart failure is associated with a higher risk for cancer. And then we can get into other lifestyles, such as too much alcohol, poor nutrition, physical activity, and even diabetes, you know. So all of these share many of the same pathways and lead to both heart disease and cancer. And what we need to remember is that people that have heart disease may be at higher risk for cancer, and people who have cancer may be at higher risk for heart disease. It's a bi-directional component that's involved.
So you just listed some pretty significant risk factors, and there's a question in the chat which I think is actually interesting, and that is, the specific question is, do you feel that obesity is worse than smoking? Which really brings up a larger question about, you know, if somebody has several of these risk factors, how do they prioritize what to address?
Right, right. You know, unfortunately, you know, risk factors are additive. So let's say you smoke and you drink too much alcohol, or you smoke and you're obese, or you smoke and you're obese and you have hypertension, you know, you're really increasing the chance. You know, to be honest, I don't know what is the worst risk factor to have. I would say the way to start is to treat what you could treat. So for instance, when I see a patient, I have to determine what are their goals and what are they committed to doing? What motivates them to change? So for instance, they may not be ready to stop smoking, but they may be ready to lose weight. So I'll start with obesity in that case. And maybe in 6 months, I could get them to decrease the number of cigarettes they smoke. You know, so everyone is different. Which is a more potent risk factor? You know, I would say tobacco is probably listed as one of the most potent risk factors that we have.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that the downward trend is pleasing on that note for sure. So, you know, you mentioned a bidirectional relationship. So it's, I think, a safe assumption then that if you work on lowering the risk of one, you're going to lower the risk of the other, which is really an important take home, because people who have both conditions might get kind of confused about what to address first. And it's further complicated by the fact that some people, for example, who are treated with cancer, because of the nature of the treatments that they receive, will actually develop heart disease as a result of their cancer treatment. And so I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit more about what causes that, how does that happen, you know, just your experience with that.
Sure, sure. You know, because I have seen this, and, you know, thankfully, you know, compared to 30 years ago when I came out of my training, there are a lot more cancer therapies. So people with cancer are surviving, you know, much better and much longer. So we could talk about chemotherapy. You know, the list of chemotherapy is long, and it's beyond the scope of this discussion. But, you know, one of the most well-known problems with some of the drugs is that they actually damage the cardiomyocyte. They damage the heart muscle cell. Some of these drugs include HER2 new directed drugs, anthracyclines, alkylating agents. And what they do is they damage the heart muscle cell. So the heart muscle cell can't work. And then people can go into heart failure. They can develop what's called a cardiomyopathy. Less well known is that some of the cancer drugs, such as tyrosine kinase inhibitors, VEGF, some of the monoclonal antibodies, they can increase blood pressure, and they actually can damage the lining of the blood vessels and cause atherosclerosis. So, you know, these people can have, besides hypertension, they can have heart attacks. That also happens sometimes with cisplatin and sometimes with 5-FU. And there's other agents that can even result in rhythm problems and deep vein thrombosis and thromboembolic disease. So it looks as if, you know, we have all these great drugs, but at the same time, we have to be acutely aware of what damage they can cause to the cardiovascular system. And, you know, because of that, there's this new specialty in cardiology called cardio-oncology, which is wonderful because there are cardiologists now that subspecialize in the field of cancer and the heart. I'm not, you know, full disclosure, I'm not a cardio-oncologist, even though I've seen patients with cancer. But, you know, I think the field is really necessary because we need, there's big practice gaps in how we treat our cancer patients. And I think it's going to be good. I also want to mention something about radiation therapy, because sometimes we may not think that that could be toxic to the heart, but it can be. If the radiation is to the chest, then it can cause inflammation of the lining of the thin sac around the heart, the pericardium. It can cause pericarditis. It can cause damage to the arteries of the heart, which also can cause atherosclerotic disease. And it can damage the valves, you know, causing stenosis of the valves, where the valves don't open or close properly. And we see this damage many, many years later. So unfortunately, you know, what I've seen in my practice sometimes is the downstream results and the end results, rather than, you know, having somebody go under a proper surveillance after having cancer therapy. And that's where the field of cardio-oncology, I think, is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it is such a great advancement. And I think some of our listeners probably live in areas where they're not going to encounter a cardio-oncologist or a oncology cardiologist. And so, you know, that it's just also, I think what I'm hearing you say is that the awareness is pervasive throughout cardiology in a way that it wasn't before. You know, a lot of, and I think that's true for oncology too. A lot of my patients, before they even start treatment, are routinely sent to a cardiologist now to just get a heart exam, which is so great because that was not happening a bit of time ago. So I want to transition to integrative approaches. This is your bailiwick, and I think an important thing to talk about. So let's start with mindfulness. I know that you're very passionate about that. And how would you say that that's impactful for both heart health, cancer risk?
Yeah, that's really a great question. I'm passionate about meditation in general. And, you know, mindfulness is a specific form of meditation. But, you know, I found that some of my patients can't practice mindfulness. So I try to find what it is they can do that will assist them in stress reduction. Because, you know, meditation is necessary not only for our physical health, but our spiritual and mental health. And, you know, there's many different ways to meditate. So there are activities that that can become meditative. You know, a lot of my patients say, I can't meditate. I can't, you know, empty my brain. I say, well, you don't have to empty your brain. You know, there's a lot of meditative activities like painting, cooking, walking in nature. Mindfulness is a specific form. And what's great about mindfulness is that it's been studied more in, well, in heart disease, but also a lot more in cancer, especially when it comes to breast cancer. And what meditation does is it decreases stress hormones, it decreases inflammation, it decreases oxidation. You know, there's a lot of evidence that it improves depression, anxiety, and fatigue that's related to cancer and to cancer treatment. Mindfulness even increases melatonin, and I'm sure you're probably a fan of melatonin, yes, because there's some evidence that it has anti-cancer properties. So there's no downside to practicing mindfulness and or any other form of meditation that helps reduce stress. Certainly the evidence is there for heart disease, and it's also now being found in prevention of cancer and in reduction of cancer-related fatigue and pain, insomnia. It's really great.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think it's, you know, in some ways it's mentioned a lot, but it's not really emphasized as much as it should because it's so impactful, just its ability to reduce stress. And stress is such a major underlying issue for both cancer and heart disease. Another area of interest of mine is exercise and the impact that exercise has on, you know, cancer risk. We know that exercise for sure, especially for certain cancers like breast cancer and colon cancer, can reduce the risk of recurrence, reduce the risk of progression in some situations. It gets a little tricky with, I would think, cardiovascular disease because it can be challenging to do strenuous exercise. So what are your thoughts around exercise and heart disease?
Well, you know, first I tell my patients that they shouldn't be afraid to exercise. They should be afraid to not exercise, you know, that what I do is I meet them where they're at. So as long as they're not having an acute coronary syndrome and they're not having heart failure, you know, even if their blood pressure is very high, they can still start exercising. So it's the rare patient that, you know, a patient who's not in the hospital or acutely ill can exercise, but I meet the patient where they're at. So if they are sedentary, I encourage them to walk a few minutes several times a day. If they tell me I can't walk 5 minutes, then I'd say walk 3 minutes, do it every few hours. If they're athletes, you know, telling them to exercise 30 minutes a day is not going to benefit them. So we have to look at the patient individually and decide what is it that's going to be best for them. You know, and I agree with the American College of Sports Medicine recommendations that we should all be getting, you know, 150 minutes of moderate aerobic activity or 75 minutes of vigorous activity. And what's interesting, you know, even though more vigorous activity is associated with less cardiovascular disease, the steepest slope of benefit is when somebody goes from sedentary to exercising at all. So I tell people, you know, I don't want people discouraged. I don't want them looking at the ACSM recommendations and saying, oh, I can't do that, so I'm not going to do it. I think that any activity is better than no activity. And the other thing to remember is inactivity is dangerous. Being physically inactive, going and walking for 1 hour and then sitting in your chair or lying down the next 23 hours is not good. So I try to help my patients find ways to activate their day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really smart and very important and reasonable, which is ultimately how people get more active. So nutrition is a huge topic, and I think we can both agree that we're, you know, in favor of a plant-forward, kind of anti-inflammatory, whole foods-based diet. But I'm curious if you have any unique or maybe less well-known dietary tips for somebody who wants to improve their heart health.
Oh, yeah, I do. I knew you'd ask that. first of all, they should have grown up in my home with my yaya cooking every meal. No, but seriously, you know, we grew up probably going through a gallon of olive oil every week. And, you know, we're only a family of six. So, wow. You know, as you know, Mediterranean diets are not low fat diets. But what's interesting is the only day we had red meat, which was lamb, of course, was on Sundays or on holidays. You know, there wasn't meat the other days. And, you know, there's some evidence that red meat could be associated with a higher risk of cancer and higher risk of heart disease. I definitely agree with, you know, mostly plant-based and definitely, you know, olive oil. I don't think there's any secret. We know about whole grains and the fiber and the advantages that a Mediterranean style diet will add. I think one of the things that I try to get to my patients is that they need to sit and they need to eat mindfully and they need to enjoy the food. And that's, you know, food in my family was the way that we spoke to each other, basically. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's very important. A mindful eating is important. And obviously, to get rid of sugar. And I don't recommend alcohol as a, you know, alcohol has been, you know, touted as having benefits, and then it's not good, then it's good. If somebody's not drinking alcohol, I tell them, I don't say to them, you should drink because it's going to help you. If anything, I have more trouble getting people to drink less, you know, and when they tell me they drink a glass of wine a day, I ask them, how much is it? You know, a glass, a big glass, or is it a Vivian glass, you know, like 5 ounces. So I think we need to limit our alcohol. We definitely need to limit our sugar. And we shouldn't be afraid of fat. It should be good fat, fresh vegetables and good fruit.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. So olive oil, top of your list, perhaps. And then interesting about alcohol only because, you know, there's lots of data points that show alcohol is a carcinogen. The more alcohol one drinks on a regular basis, the higher the risk of certain cancers for sure, but that there's almost an inverse relationship with heart disease. But you're saying that there is a limit too to where that benefit kind of starts to taper off.
Yeah, there's definitely a U shape, so that if you don't drink any alcohol, there's a bit of a higher risk. But you know, a bit of alcohol is really just a little bit of alcohol. It might be, you know, 5 ounces a day of wine, of good wine, you know, preferably Pinot Noir from Oregon. But, you know, but the problem I have is, you know, it also, when you drink a little, it makes you want to drink more. Right. So that's one of the problems. So if somebody is a smart drinker, that's okay. But, you know, I certainly don't think that it is the best thing we can do for our bodies or our brains or, you know, for the prevention of cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. What other strategies do you just feel are essential? Like you just can't wait to tell people about to help reduce their risk of heart disease, risk of cancer, improve their health overall?
That's a tough question. There's so many things I do that go beyond the conventional. You know, we discussed lifestyle, but you know, you could look at micronutrient status and supplement accordingly. You can do personalized medicine with genomics. You could go to acupuncture, which is treating, but I see that we're running out. So what I think is the most important is that I listen to my patients' stories, because I need to know what gives them joy and what makes them tick and what is their purpose. And I think we are all born with a purpose, and having it and knowing it can add years to your life and good years.
Sounds good. Very wise and, you know, gentle, but impactful. So what thoughts, final thoughts that you have that you think are important for our listeners to hear just on this topic in general?
Well, what I want to tell people is if you have cancer, make sure that you have some surveillance from a cardiologist that's aware of the data. Your oncologist could probably help you with that. If you have heart disease, know your risks and see, you know, that there are ways to reduce your risks, because certainly they can reduce your chance of cardiovascular events. And, you know, I want to let everybody know that, you know, you have an incredible power to heal, and that it doesn't just come from drugs, although drugs can be important, and doesn't just come from surgery or procedures, but it comes from within you. So, you know, there are ways to foster this, and, you know, just work with somebody that hears you and, you know, be well.
Yeah, I think, you know, that I'm glad you ended that way. I think the relationship between patient and practitioner is really an important thing, can be an important thing. I mean, it's not always possible for people to shop around and find a person that they really connect with. But when that happens, I think it can be a very impactful part of somebody's healing. So on that note, tell us where people can find you. Do you have a website that you can share?
Yes. Yes, I do. It's basically my name. It's D as in David R with my name, Kominos, KOMINOS.com. And it has information about my practice, my practice location, and information about me.
Wonderful. Well, I'm so glad that you are out there doing what you do and teaching fellows to do what they do. And just am very grateful that you're in this world doing integrative cardiology. Got that right. So thank you so much for spending some of your time with us.
It's my pleasure.
Great. And this wraps up this episode of 5 to Thrive Live. Again, we thank our sponsors, Cetria Glutathione, the superior antioxidant to support liver and immune health, Dr. Ohira's Probiotics, award-winning pre- and probiotic formulas based on traditional Asian fermentation, Hyatt Life Sciences, the proud manufacturer of Afia Plus, and the iThrive Plan, an online personalized lifestyle program to transform from survivor to thriver. So thank you all for joining us. May you experience joy, laughter, and love. It's time to thrive, everyone. Have a great night.